my dears. Welcome back to another edition of Hey, How'd You Get That Music Job? I am your host, L. Ariel, and we can be found at musicjobspodcast.com. That's musicjobs with an S, podcast.com. Hope everyone is doing well. Hey, we're also on streaming platforms, iTunes, Google Play, Stitcher Podcast, iHeartRadio, TuneIn, and more. If you are listening to us on one of those streaming platforms, do us a favor, give us some stars, give us some feedback so we can be bumped up in the rankings so more people can find out about our little podcast. Hey, how'd you get that music job? Because we are all about talking to the movers and shakers and innovators from all areas of the music biz. That's right. We tell you right here how the sausage is made. We go back to the very beginning. We hear all about their music journey, their music career journey. What decisions did they make? What obstacles did they face? What advice and insights do they have to share with the rest of us? My guest last week was John Del Vento. He is a film and TV composer, really dropped some great knowledge. He really worked his butt off to get to where he is today, a very successful film and TV composer. So go on back and listen to that episode if you haven't had a chance to already. My next guest I'm very excited to share with you is Michael Beinhorn. He is an incredible songwriter, producer. He has worked with everyone from the Red Hot Chili Peppers to Soundgarden to Marilyn Manson. He has produced and co-written some incredible seminal albums. He actually just collaborated on Weezer's latest album that just dropped Friday, the Black Album. What I'm really excited about, among other things, is that he actually co-wrote and co-produced Rocket, Herbie Hancock's landmark recording, which actually has become Columbia Records' most successful 12-inch single ever, selling over 3 million copies and winning a Grammy for Best R&B Instrumental Recording. I fucking love this song so much, so I was super excited to talk to Michael, among other things. But let me just stop talking. Let's play a clip from Rocket, and then let's get on with the show. Hey, how'd you get that music job?
Hi, thank you, Ariel.
Yeah.
I didn't pronounce that right, did I?
L. Ariel.
L. Ariel, excuse me.
No worries.
All right.
All right, so tell me, first memories of music. Tell me all about it.
My parents were tremendous music enthusiasts, so I was kind of bombarded with the stuff. Plus, my mom was a classical, I guess she was an opera, kind of opera singer-ish sort of person, and she played piano a lot. So she would sit me on her lap when I was teeny, and she'd play and she would sing, and there I was. So I was kind of I was in the thick of it, and I don't remember any of that, but I do recall running around the house listening to, I think, my two favorites at that time, apart from Beatles records, which my folks started playing for me also. I really liked Strauss's Blue Danube and Beethoven's Ninth Symphony. And that really got me going for whatever reason. It was really exciting to listen to, and it just made me feel like nothing else.
Wow. Tell us about your first experience playing music. Did you start taking lessons? Did you just gravitate towards an instrument? What did that look like?
I started taking piano lessons. I wasn't that young. Like, I was probably about like 9 or 10 or something like that. But I don't think I showed a tremendous interest in it. I just love music in general. I wasn't drawn towards it, really. I'm playing an instrument, and I never really excelled as a musician because it really wasn't where I wanted to go. So actually playing was a bit more laborious for me than anything else, like learning the technical aspects of it.
Uh-huh.
And after I stopped playing, it all kind of fell away. But really the thing that I loved about music as much as anything was listening to it and I guess seeing what happened in my mind, what it did to my brain when I was listening to it, like kind of really paying attention to that effect, which I think is pretty unusual because I've actually never heard anyone refer to it quite that way. It just always had a really profound emotional effect on me. And that's what really I found myself focusing on. Even once I started playing in a band, and I didn't really gravitate towards a keyboard per se, it was more of a synthesizer. That was the thing. I was more interested in sound and sound manipulation than I was in actual, you know, in actual songs or notes or anything like that. It was more the sonics.
So did you, when you were listening to music and realizing this effect on you, were you kind of detaching from it and saying, wow, this is sort of like a really powerful mind altering substance? Or I'm just curious to hear more about that.
Well, I didn't have any kind of point of reference as far as that might go, mm-hmm. you know, because we're talking like, you know, I started to be aware of this when I was like 5 or 6, you know, and I hadn't experimented with any mind-altering substances at that point.
Well, that's good.
I think it's better. But myself, no, but I was really aware. And what it did do was it kind of detached me from, I guess, my sense of what reality was. You know, all the kind of mundane aspects of life just kind of fell away. And there I was, kind of in this, I don't know, it was almost like a communion with this sensation and with these images. And I guess with the thoughts and feelings of the people who'd created this, even though I wasn't aware of that until much later on, you know, that was what was going on, that it was something that profound as well. But it was like a whole different universe got opened up to me at that point. And, you know, I realized that you could use music as something to, I guess, escape from a perception of reality, as well as using it as a way to augment reality. And it was really fascinating. It was purely a sensory experience. I didn't have any kind of any reference point that I could intellectualize or, you know, or reference it to.
Right. Uh-huh. I hear a baby.
There he is. Yep.
He's already singing. I love it.
He is actually. He's got a wonderful voice.
Oh, cutie pie. Yeah. So yeah, it was funny when you were talking, I had a split second memory. And again, that's that powerful music hitting sort of those memory banks as well, is like being in the back seat, having my Walkman on and listening to Outstanding by the Gap Band.
Oh yeah.
and it's like, I remember it again, like it was yesterday, and I didn't want to hear my parents bickering. Right. I just wanted to be lost in Charlie Wilson's beautiful voice. And I will get tears sometimes when I, you know, when that song comes on, because it's just such a visceral memory.
Well, and you're also, the thing that's amazing about visceral experiences, things that are really somatic, that you have a somatic attachment to, is that they'll take you right back to the place, for better or for worse, where you were at when you first experienced them and when they had the most profound effect on you. And this happens with all, this can happen with all kinds of things that have a visceral and, you know, thereby emotional effect on you. Music definitely does that, you know. And you can remember points in time when it kind of altered your perception of things, you know, when it changed how you felt about stuff and how you may have used this as a way to feel good or to feel stuff that you might not have been able to experience any other way. It's very therapeutic in that sense.
Yeah, it really is. And I think that was what was really powerful is that, and I'm sure you'll understand this as an artist, but I actually heard Charlie Wilson smile through the song. How do you hear a smile? But I but I heard it. You know what I mean? It was just incredible because it was, you could tell he was smiling when he sang, "You Blow My Mind." It was just, I get chills still thinking about it, like being, you know, that tween, miserable tween in the back seat and, and having that moment of like, holy shit, I just heard a smile. Yeah. First time in my life, you know?
And that's a real gift. That's a real gift. That's honestly true. It's a really beautiful thing. Yeah. I mean, you will have that for the rest of your life.
Right. Well, enough about me. So tell us,
fine.
Tell us about this band. Did you decide to form a band or how did that come about?
Well, after I bought a synthesizer, I found out that not many other people had them, at least not that I knew. And I guess from a musical standpoint or a band standpoint, I became kind of popular, being the only kid that anyone knew who had a teeny little synthesizer, such as it was. Eventually, I hooked up with a friend who I played in a band with, and we started seeing these flyers and handbills all over, I guess, lower Manhattan that reference names of bands that we were really into that were very obscure at the time. They were like, you know, proggy, sort of very obscure bands. And we thought no one else knew about this. So the person who'd put the handbills up was, you know, requesting that people come to this performance space and jam and, you know, let's get together and see what happens. You know, so he went down there. It was on 24th Street, and it was this guy's building. And we met a guy named Bill Laswell, and we wound up forming a group called Material with him. That was the start of that. That was in 1977.
That's what a great opportunity. I mean, that's amazing, you know, that it was that accessible.
Well, everything was really accessible at that time. And in a different way, you know, you had to really kind of go out and look for it, but it was there if you wanted it. I guess it was a more kind of hands-on version of the internet, you know, but like, I also felt after a while, like these things were happening because I was open to them. You know, these opportunities, these occurrences, they all happened because I was ready for them because they were supposed to be there, and it was all, you know, it all dovetailed very nicely, you know. So it seemed that there's a bit of kismet there.
Did you feel intimidated at all, or you were just like, no, this is, I mean, because it sounds pretty confident.
I mean, I was a very insecure kid, but like, but as far as intimidated, like, you know, as far as I knew, we were all just a bunch of people who loved the same music and were interested in the same things. And there wasn't anything intimidating about it at all. It was like, you know, just finding kindred spirits. That was more important than anything. It was really amazing. It was great. And it was such a good time to be in New York as well. And doing, it's a whole different landscape.
Mm-hmm. Can you talk a little bit more about that? Because I don't think people really know as much as they should about that. Like the fact that you could find a flyer and then suddenly walk into this building and be part of this incredible music experience.
Well, you have to realize that New York at that time in history was an absolute shithole. It was incredible. It was a mess. It was going through a financial depression of unparalleled. I think it was probably as bad or close to, it was closing in on the way things were during the depression. I think, I mean, there were still very wealthy people in the city, and there's actually a thriving middle class, which you don't really see, which you can't find at all now. But there was also the amount of decrepitude and crime and poverty was just, it was astounding. I mean, if you went too far into Alphabet City, which is the area where the avenues go A, B, C, D, so on, you could go down one block and you'd see buildings in the next, you know, I guess within a few feet, you'd start seeing buildings that were completely demolished. Like nothing was there, burnt out, and no one had bothered to fix anything up. Like the real estate was worthless. You know, now that real estate is worth hundreds of millions of dollars. But back then, like no one even wanted to go near it. Like that's where gangs were. That's where drugs were. But there was also a massive, massive community of artists. know. I mean, from the 19, oh man, I guess throughout the early part of the 20th century, there was a thriving art community in even earlier, but like Manhattan and lower Manhattan in particular, hosted this amazing community of artists, you know, and after the war, a lot of people came back or, you know, had grown up and the abstract expressionist movement started and the beat poet started and all this, like, you know, all these new forms of jazz started developing and they evolved so rapidly. And everything kind of cross-pollinated and cross-fertilized. All the mediums kind of were thriving in this great big melting pot. And, you know, so you could have these like unbelievably terrible social conditions, which of course bled into the counterculture in the 60s, you know, which I actually got to see a bit of because that's when I started when I was growing up. And you saw how it fed the 70s. And from the 60s, after people became very disillusioned because they realized that, like, the counterculture wasn't going to change anything, and if people were falling into the same traps that they'd been in for a long time, at that point, I think people, you know, became more jaded and the financial situation started to turn and there was more of a sense of me, me, me. But there's still this art community was thriving and growing and developing, and it was, you know, actually kind of falling into that and becoming part of it was extraordinary. You know, like, I don't think there's never been a time quite like that in American history or in world history even. And I don't think that there will be again, you know. I mean, hopefully there'll be something similar, but it's going to be different because you know, being able to repeat the social conditions and everything that surrounded it, it's not going to happen. But you could find, you found people who were so open to experimentation and so absolutely free of any kind of restraints, and no one cared about making money at all. That was the absolute last thing on people's minds, you know? It was basically about how much further can I get? And a lot of it was competition too. Like, you know, I gotta be cooler than those guys. A lot of it was actually, instead of making money, you had like, who's cooler, you know, who's the coolest person, you know, like, who's got the most obvious heroin addiction, you know, because that was stuff that people cared about a lot more, you know. But like, musically, everyone just wanted to go as far out as they could and make the coolest, wildest, most mind-blowing stuff possible. And it was an amazing, amazing time to be in the midst of a community, to be making music, to be in the thick of a community just like that one, you know, immediately post-punk rock. It was incredible.
Yeah. And I think you're right. I mean, I don't think enough has been said about that, you know.
No.
What an incredible time it really was.
Yeah.
And I was like, you know, I'm more a child of the 80s, so I sort of just viewed it through a very limited childlike mind, you know, the 70s. But yeah, I think it can be a black hole in some respects that people just don't know. You know, it's like 60s to 80s, and it's like, no, there's a lot in between.
Yeah.
You know? So I love that you shared that. That's so great.
Oh, it was an amazing time. And I mean, when people look back on it now, they look back on how ruined the city was and how bad it looked, you know, and pictures of like hookers in the streets and people riding on the trains with graffiti all over them and stuff, and how absolutely polluted the, you know, Manhattan Island was. But there was so much happening culturally. I mean, like, I knew people who lived in lofts then as opposed to living in lofts now. And as an artist, you could get loft space. Like, two families who shared a loft on 2nd Avenue between 13th and 14th, and they owned a loft that was an entire block long. I mean, they didn't own it, but like, they were renting it for about $300 a month.
Oh my God, it's just insane. Wow.
It was crazy. They owned basically a factory. The inside, like, what had been like a factory with like a railroad design. It was just open rooms all the way down, you know, from one block to the other, and for $300.
That's unbelievable. Yeah. And I think of Venice, which has obviously gone through hyper gentrification, but there, I remember there was like t-shirts, you know, 10, 15 years ago, it was like where art meets crime, you mm-hmm. know, when it was like still kind of Venice. And you see like downtown LA, like there's different cities that have gone through that, what you're describing, you know, where it was just a shithole and it was a glorious shithole and artists were able to freely have a community and express themselves and have this unlimited sort of freedom of the landscape. And then, uh-huh. you know, suddenly developers move in, et cetera, gentrification, et cetera, et cetera. Man. So
I loved the art district here so much because I think probably because it reminded me of a lot of that stuff, except it was different because it was really quiet. Like it was one place where you could go and no one else wanted to be there. And all you were was surrounded by artists. That was it. You know, even though it was heavy industry, you didn't really hear any noise. It was just, it was quiet. You could go out of your building and you could walk like 2 a.m. There'd be no one out. There'd probably be like a homeless person lying in the street or staggering around. That was about it, you know? And we wound up moving back there about like 5 years ago or something like that. And we had to go because like all of a sudden there was a brewery on our block and then there was another brewery and that was the end of it. It was like,
those fucking breweries.
And then all the people came and everyone's getting drunk and throwing up on the side of your building and getting into screaming arguments at, you know, at 1 a.m. with their girlfriend, you know, outside your window. And you're like, shut the fuck up. You know, this used to be a quiet place where we could like think and focus on our art and you motherfuckers.
Yeah, it's, yeah, things have changed for sure, but that's why I love hearing about this. So to get back to the music, so you're in this band and then was there any thought of like continuing education or did you just completely immerse yourself now in the New York music scene? Like, tell us about that.
I just went for it. You know, like the experience that I started to get from being that person, I think far outweighed anything at that point in time that I could have gotten from, you know, going to school or anything like that. I did further my education in synth technology, which at that time was mainly modular instruments. And I learned how to use a Buchla 200 series, which was a lot of fun, not relevant to what I was doing in this band, of course. But, you know, I began to encounter so many different people, you know, obviously musicians of like a ridiculously high caliber and, you know, and also people who weren't, but had so much drive and ambition and desire to, you know, to be part of this whole thing and to just, you know, take advantage of what was happening and really kind of show themselves out. It was like this gigantic petri dish. It was incredible.
Where did you do the synth technology? I'm curious. Where did you study that?
There was a place in Manhattan called PASS, which is Public Access Synthesizer Studio.
No way! I love that.
You could come in. You could come into this place. It was like on 21st Street or something, and you could rent their synths. Like you could spend an hour, 2 hours, just like messing around on these big modular systems. And I went there to, you know, it was kind of a job. Like I was sort of an assistant there for a few hours a day, just kind of minding the place and, you know, helping whoever came in, you know, do what they were doing. And, you know, and they gave me some lessons there as well. It was fantastic.
That is so cool. So was that the earning aspect of being a musician? Is that how you were able to feed yourself?
No. I didn't make any money doing that. I'm not sure how I was able to eat at that point.
Isn't that funny? You probably thrived on very little.
I did. Actually, I had a job at a place called David's Cookies, which was up on 53rd and 2nd, I think, between 53rd and 54th. And it was this sort of hoity-toity cookie store, which was very, very, very different than the kind of life that I was living downtown. But it was really funny. After, and I just, I needed the money, but I just wasn't having the lifestyle. So I'd come in and put the soundtrack to Apocalypse Now on, and you know.
That's amazing.
It changed people's. What was funny was that people actually came in and would like recognize what was going on. It's like, no way. It was really funny. Yeah, I was a pretty cranky little 21-year-old at that point, playing Apocalypse Now in the cookie store.
I love that. That sounds like an art exhibit.
It kind of was. It was pretty amusing.
Wow, that's amazing. So kind of walk us through the next chapter. Where did things go from there?
We just played around. You know, we played in New York City. We wound up going to Europe to play at the Berlin Jazz Festival in 81 and a few gigs. No, we stayed in Berlin. I'm trying to remember. I only remember playing in Berlin, which is amazing. You know, it's the first time I was abroad. You know, then the name started getting around. We did some recording with Brian Eno, which was really eye-opening. And then we wound up getting hooked up with Herbie Hancock.
Wow. You know,
it was very serendipitous. We, you know, the chances of that happening were so, like, immeasurably, infinitesimally small. But somehow Herbie was at the end of his deal with Sony. He wasn't going to get re-signed. And I think he was in a position where basically he didn't have anything to lose. And he had a guy working with him who hooked him up with us. It kind of really chatted us up a lot to Herbie. And so Herbie just decided, okay, let's take a chance. Let's do two songs and see what happens. And we did two initial songs with him as kind of a test run. And one of them happened to be Rocket.
Oh my God. I love it. I love it. So cool.
Yeah. We kind of hit that one out of the park on the first go around. And after that, even though Herbie, I don't think was really sure about what we were doing, he knew something was going on. He was like, all right, let's make the rest of the record with these guys. So, you know, we did that, and not really prepared for or expecting what was going to come next. And, you know, the rest, as they say, is history.
Wow. Do you feel like there was much more kind of cross-pollination going on between different music genres at that time?
Absolutely. Absolutely. There's no question about it. I find that people from different genres will guest on people's records now.
Right. The feet. They get the feet, right? Featuring. Yeah.
Yes, exactly. But it's exactly. But there's a real sense of contrivance to that, I feel. Like it's sort of, it's kind of like they did that to kind of, to extend the range of what they were doing. But I always feel like it's more for market-based kind of considerations rather than creative ones. Whereas, you know, 1980s, it was like, what can we do? Like, what hasn't been done? What abyss can be breached that no one's thought of breaching yet? You know, what can we bring together that's going to create a like almost effortless and seamless kind of fusion between two music forms or two artists that have never come together? I mean, like in material, we'd been doing this for a while. You know, we did records where we had a lot of weird electronic stuff and people from the jazz scene. And we did one record where we featured Whitney Houston for her very first, I guess, professional recording. And we had a guy from the group Chic playing keyboards and a sax player named Archie Shepp, who is a very famous avant-garde jazz player. You know, so we tried to do things that were really off the beaten track at that point, you know. So at that point, hooking up with Herbie wasn't much of a stretch, but what we did with Herbie was, you know, I mean, bringing a fledgling music form to a jazz rock performer and a famous jazz musician as well, and creating this fusion. You know, first of all, people in record companies barely took hip hop seriously. I mean, it wasn't a music form that anyone thought they were going to have tremendous success with. I mean, 2 years before, there had been four massive hits, Buffalo Gals, The Message, Planet Rock, and Magnificent Seven by The Clash, which I don't think everyone considers a hip-hop record, but you have to remember that it was being that song by a rock band was actually being played on R&B stations all over New York City, which was that was weird. That was flat out weird. No one could believe it, but you would hear it and you'd be like, "Well, there it is." I mean, people were really considering the value of combining music forms, you know, and really not homogenizing, but kind of but extending the range of what they could do in their own in terms of their own genre. These days, people are so intensely genre based, and they can't see beyond the genre that they don't consider the fact that they could do so much more with what they've got.
Yeah, exactly. And I think that's a great point. The word that came to mind when you were talking is alchemy. I think that was the difference, you know, versus like a corporate, very corporate profit-driven incentive to have, yes, this artist guest feature on this, because then we can tap into both fan bases. Instead, what you guys were doing were literally like chemists. What if we mix this with this and what do we get?
I think you called it perfectly.
So where did this Herbie Hancock rocket ship take you next? Because that's next level, right? You're like in a completely new, I don't know, world, so to speak, right? It won a bunch of Grammys, right?
In a word, yes. One Grammy. It was up for two. It changed my landscape completely. You know, all of a sudden I see my name and my partner's name as winning like the Rolling Stone critics poll for like best production team, you know, over like people who'd been doing this kind of stuff for years. And there we are at number one. I'm like, oh my God, you know, I'm 23 years old. I can't make any sense out of it at all. You know, a little while ago, I was just some little kid who had these like crazy ideas. And now what, you know, So where it took me was actually out of material. we sort of parted ways toward the end of the year or at the beginning of the next year. And I found myself on my own, which was a very strange place to be because I'd never been in that position before, thrust into the music business world. And I had attained this immense cachet, or my song had, but I found out very quickly that no one actually knew who the hell I was.
Right.
People actually identified that song with my partner, you know, and he'd taken tremendous amount of care to ensure that people knew that it was him, you know, that it was his creation. So I was kind of in a position where, okay, I don't have any money. I don't have any acclaim. I don't have any, I guess, public image, or there's no public knowledge of who I am. So I'm kind of starting over here. And that was pretty daunting. So I wound up doing what I think anyone else in my position would do. And that was like, go to A&R people and beg for work.
Interesting.
And, you know, I most of them just kind of looked at me and were very dismissive. And it was an incredible learning experience. Like it really forced me to grow up super quickly. And, you know, because it was really at that point, it's like, well, you're going to sink or you're going to swim. And if you don't like it, you can always go back to Forest Hills, Queens and get a job like delivering fruit to people.
Or know. More cookies, Apocalypse yeah, Now cookies, right?
That would have kept me in New York, which would have been nice. But, you know, so I really had to take this very seriously. And, you know, no matter how scared I was, no matter how bad I felt about it, I just kept taking these meetings or setting these meetings up with people. And I did work on a few records in the interim, but it took me to a meeting with a guy at EMI Records who said, I might actually have something for you. I have this band that no one wants to work with here. And I was like, oh, cool. Yeah, they're called the Red Hot Chili Peppers.
Oh, my God.
Yeah. So, you know, that's where I wound up after 3 years of being, you know, out on my own.
Let me ask you real quick. Did you feel like, because today, with today's sort of DIY musician, there's a lot of this, you know, you have to have the mindset of a businessman, an entrepreneur, you have to have branding, you have to have marketing. Did you feel like that was something that you needed at that point when you were on your own and realizing your partner was kind of like stealing all the limelight? Tell me about that. Like, or was it just a case of like, you just had to like hustle your ass off?
We had no idea what any of that was. I mean,
yeah,
I, you know, and the thing is that back then, see the thing, you know, you can really take advantage of that because people are serious about presentation now, even if there's nothing behind the presentation. Like the presentation is often got more substance to it than what's actually, than what the presentation is trying to advertise. Back then, if you couldn't deliver the goods, no one gave a shit about you. That, it's as simple as that. So you could have advertised the hell out of yourself. And I did know people who did, you know, who were much more shameless, I guess, about how they presented themselves, for lack of a better way of putting it. And for the most part, people like those were looked down upon and kind of laughed at, you know, because a lot of times they didn't have what it took, you know, they couldn't deliver, you know, so people knew, oh, well, obviously if it's like that, then they don't really have what they, you know, what we need to be able to make the right kind of record. You know, it's definitely much different today. Unfortunately, in a lot of cases, though, it's still true. Like a lot of people who are able to advertise very well don't necessarily have what in the end is going to make a record great.
Yeah, that's a great point. And I think of like catfishing, you know, how they, I think there was a musician I read about recently who like created, he was like this prog rock dude who created this entire persona, band following, et cetera, online. It was all bots. It was all fake. And he booked a bunch of venues in Europe and the promoters were like, what the fuck? Cause you know, Nobody showed up because bots don't go to venues, you know, like, And it was just this like huge catfishing operation that again, this dude just pulled off completely online.
One of the greatest catfishing expeditions in recent history actually has a documentary on it on Netflix, the whole Fire Festival, you know. Yeah. I mean, what was that if it wasn't like a tremendous catfishing expedition? It's essentially conferring on people because of their ability to advertise the idea that they are probably most likely absolute geniuses because they've created this thing when all they have created is the appearance of the thing, not the actual substance. They can't deliver. You know, and that's what a lot of, I guess, even music creation is about now. It's about creating the appearance of something without having the substance to back it up. You know, the substance is what stays with people and hits people super hard. You know, the appearance of something, you can find that anywhere. Just go on Instagram for like 25, you know, 15 minutes and you will see, you'll see the appearances of things, most of which is completely made up, you know. Like, it's really funny. Sometimes, like, I've seen things. I'm not an Instagram dweller, but I've seen things where people post this stuff about, you know, childcare and what they're doing with their kids and stuff like that. And it makes them appear to be incredible, like, probably the best parents that ever lived in the history of the world. You know, that they can do all this stuff and they're also fantastically wealthy. And, you know, what they're not showing you is the fact that they've got like two or three nannies and they can kind of, and these people can go and like, they can go to the gym. They can like go in their sauna. They can spend as much time away from their children as they need to. So they look all fresh and, you know, and they also look like they weigh, you know, 100 pounds and they're ripped and stuff like that. You know, and meanwhile, you know, I've got like a little belly and stuff like that. And I can't make it to the gym as much as I'd like to, you know, and, you know, but also that kind of thing like makes other people look at what they do and they're like, well, I guess I suck. And it's like, no, you just don't advertise, you know, it's not hard to figure this stuff out. You know, it's all about advertising now, and it's really not about having the goods.
Well, we're talking about the real deal here, and that's why I love it so much. So Red Hot Chili Peppers, this band nobody wants to work with.
Nobody.
Tell us about that.
Well, where do I start? I mean, it was like, you know, I fell into this thing. Obviously, I was overjoyed to have work after all that time, you know, and I listened to their demos and I was like, wow, this isn't that good. And then I started paying attention to what was there. And I was like, no, wait a sec. There's something here. There's something really compelling about these guys. Like, they were so goofy and they were so desperate in a way, but they had this like real desire to express something. And I couldn't really tell what it was because I'd never really heard it before, you know, and I kept listening to it. And I was like, this is there's something in here that's really appealing, you know, and that's what drew me in. And I met with them and we wound up deciding that we should work together. Once I started working with them, I discovered the two of the guys in the band had ridiculously bad drug habits, which of course means heroin and nothing else. You know, so that was something I had to contend with. Additionally, they had a couple demos done, but the record company had a stipulation that they gave to the band and to me, and that was they were not going to record under any circumstances unless the record company had been presented with finished demos that they signed off on. So obviously I had a pretty, and this is the deck is stacked against this band already because the record company didn't like them. You know, they actively despised them. They wouldn't let them get out of their deal. And they were the only, you know, they didn't have anything else that was remotely like this on the label. So the band were in a tough spot and they were kind of falling to pieces. So my job was to get them over like a great many hurdles. And, you know, of course, I'm doubly hamstrung now because of the drug problems.
Right.
So it took, I'm going to say, 6-7 months of work, which included me actually kicking Anthony Kiedis out of the band.
Oh, shit.
Yeah, because it got to be too much, you know, at one point with him and the problems that he had. And it was like, and that was it, you know. And the guys were like, they were miserable. Like, one of them came up to me at a club one night, and he gave me this big hug and started crying. Like, he was just sobbing. And I was like, oh, God, this is, you know, these poor guys. I got to do something. And the management was like, I mean, he was great, but he was just kind of like a deer in the headlights. It was the whole thing was a mess. And Anthony went back to his mom's in Michigan and cleaned up. And in the meantime, we were auditioning singers, you know, and I just helped the band get their songs together, like really build them up and construct them. Anthony got in contact with them and was like, look, I'm clean. Can I have another shot, please? And he came back and I said to him, if you stay clean, I'm going to give you all the support. I will have your back and I'll be there with you every step of the way. We did demos. We finished them. We played them for one of the guys at EMI about on a Thursday night. We were supposed to go into Capitol Studios. I booked Capitol for the following Monday. And he got up, walked out, and we were like, what do you think? He's like, we'll talk about it tomorrow. I was like, what do you mean we'll talk about it tomorrow? We're here. Let's talk about it now. And he's like, we'll talk about it tomorrow. You know, and that evolved into like a shouting match that went out into the parking area. He got in his car and he was like, you guys aren't doing anything until I say you can. I'm not going to tell you how we got out of that. But we did, and we got a green light the next day to start recording.
Wow.
Yeah.
Now, were you working, like, where was your kind of allegiance? Were you working, like, were you like cat wrangler for the label, or were you just like in the trenches with the band, like band versus label? Like, where were you at?
Well, generally speaking, even if a label hires me, my first allegiance is to the music. Like, I mean, the label Schmabel, I mean, they're, you know, sure, they might actually be paying me, which in a lot of cases is not the case, or they may have suggested me to the artist. But, you know, I have to think about the legacy of what I'm working on, what's mm-hmm. going to be, you know, where this is going to go, what it's going to wind up being, who it's going to affect, and what the long-term value is going to be. And it's always about the legacy of the recording. And who does that affect more than anyone? The artist. It doesn't affect the record company because they basically at any time are going to have maybe, you know, 10, 20, 30 projects like this going on. So they don't care. I mean, if one fails, they can rely on another. And if 10 fail, those are tax write-offs, you know, that they can apply and they'll always be solvent in one way or another. So this isn't a big deal, but for the artist, it is a big deal.
Yeah.
And it's a terminally big deal. If they don't do their best work right here, right now, they're going to have to live with the upshot. You know, mm-hmm. they're going to have to live with this for the rest of their lives. And if they do something that could be wonderful and marvelous and life-changing for people who listen to it, on the other hand, then they can establish their place in history. And my focus was on taking these guys who I really felt had something compelling to say and mm-hmm. making, I guess, documenting where they're at in that particular point in time and making sure that it was plaintively obvious and evident to anyone who listened to it. And that's what we got. I mean, the record we did was called Uplift Mofo Party Plan. And to this day, a lot of people say that it's their favorite Chili Peppers record.
You know, it's interesting listening to your trajectory too, though, because it's like you're all about following the music. You were not driven by profit. You were not driven by the bottom line. And yet here you are working with iconic artists. And I think a lot of people miss that. It's like they can't see the forest for the trees kind of thing. They chase the dollar. They chase the shiniest object in the room, that kind of thing.
Well, everyone, I think now delayed gratification isn't something that exists for a lot of people, you know, or understanding the, as you said, trajectory of a person's career. Things don't happen immediately. They don't happen like overnight or tomorrow or like in the next hour. They happen over months and years sometimes. And I think to a lot of people, what I was able to achieve happened in a relatively short amount of time, but that's the exception. That's not the rule. I consider myself, I don't like to use the term luck because I frankly don't believe in luck, but I think you could just as easily apply that word because it's really, the terminology is subjective here. It didn't happen. This is not a normal career. This is not a normal history. And it never works like that. People, and there are people who become successful incredibly fast, faster than I did, without a doubt. But that is exceptional. That is even more exceptional and even more rare. And it's important. It's really important to consider how much effort you're willing to put into this stuff and how much, you know, the degree of hard work, because no matter what happens, if you don't have, you know, you may get lucky and have a tremendous amount of success at, you know, at an early point in your life. But if you don't have talent or if you don't have the right, the requisite skill and the right combinations thereof, you won't ever be able to repeat it and you'll be gone. You know, there's just, you know, it's important to take stock of what is required to be able to be great doing what you do. And because it really, you know, it's one thing to work your way up the ladder at American Express and become a president there. You know, it's doable. And everyone understands, that, you know, what kind of time is involved in that, what kind of school education you need to be able to do that. Music is different, you know. But people make the mistake now in thinking because the technology is so readily available to do something that sounds like music, that you're actually doing something that is musical, that has the same power as music, and that will have a long-term, long-lasting effect. You know, if you make great art and you work in a popular art medium, chances are you're probably going to do something that's going to affect a lot of people. So you will be able to have success doing it. But you have to consider the art first. And this is something that people in the music industry have missed repeatedly over time. And for the life of me, I will never be able to understand that lack of vision at all.
Well, I think a lot of it, and I'd love to hear more about that, but I think a lot of it too is putting this sort of very linear business mindset on the art form. So it's starting, or it has been treated like getting a law degree, becoming a doctor, you know, and the expectations that you do, you follow these very finite, very linear steps, and then you, hurrah, you will be rewarded with this type of career. And I think that gets perpetuated by the Instagram, effortless looking, perfect, shiny. We're not going to show you how the sausage is made. We're just going to show you,
you know, this look.
The sausage, the airbrushed, yeah. Photoshopped sausage. Yeah. So, yeah, I'd love to hear more about that.
But what you just said before that, if you think about it, it sounds like a sales pitch.
Yeah.
And it is. And the reason that it is because there are other industries, there are peripheral industries that profit by this kind of mindset of like, oh, all I have to do is this, this, and this, and take that linear and follow that linear trajectory, and I will be able to be as successful as Max Martin or, you know, whomever. It's very simple. You know, there's a system. Human beings love systems. They love being able to figure out a way of doing stuff that's systematic, that they can apply and reapply to anything. And that's also one of the problems with the music industry. They believe that formula is actually a way to create hit records, when in fact it's you can create a hit record with formula, but you also need a degree of talent. You know, all the periods in history where formula was applied, you know, you can go back to like the late 50s to that if you want to, like, you know, and to records of guys like Phil Spector. I mean, his formula was something that was so personal, but it was applicable in a way where you got a tremendous rush of emotion. He understood that that what you're trying to do is stimulate people emotionally through that. You know, I mean, like his first big hit, To Know Him Is to Love Him. You know where he got that title from?
No.
It came off the headstone of his dad. Like his dad's headstone reads, To Know Him Was to Love Him.
Wow.
You know, which has an immense emotional resonance for someone doing that. And you can't help but transmit that through a musical idea. So what he's feeling comes across, even though the song doesn't betray any of that at all, there's still intense emotion behind that. And he knew how to inject that. You know, it's simple. If you don't have talent, if you don't have an expressive quality, something that you need to say, something you need to communicate, it doesn't make any difference how good your formula is. It's not going to be repeatable to the extent that you would like it to.
We're running out of time, or we went over time, but I don't care because you're so amazing and fun to talk to. But last question or point I want you to talk about, because you made me think about this with, are we entering into an episode of Black Mirror with music? Because I had an interesting conversation with a music tech journalist on the podcast a few weeks ago, and we're talking about AI and Spotify's mood playlists and this sort of idea of artificially creating the moods, the sensations through these playlists, basically reducing music to sort of this ambient force that can generate happiness, sadness, longing. What do you think about that?
I think it's ridiculous. in a word, I think it's basically further commoditizing music and reducing it to something that it really was never intended to be, and that it can't actually be and still be called music and still be the art form that it is. I mean, if you can recontextualize music, it's true. There's no question about it. But I think when you take it too far and put it into your own context and relieve it of the context that it was originally, it kind of, I guess, was birthed from, mm-hmm. you lose so much of what it's actually trying to say, so much of the character. Like, you know, take a piece of Bach's music, for example. You know, listening to it just as a piece of music, you can derive so much from it. If you take it now and put it into your playlist and go, all right, this is my like getting up in the morning or whatever type thing, you know, you've basically assigned a specific role to it. You've kind of compartmentalized it and you've completely relieved, you've taken so much away from what it does. I mean, it's not saying you shouldn't or you can't. Of course you can if you want to, but you start to forget about things like, how is this made? What's the construction of this thing? What's the meaning of it? You know, what is this guy trying to say? How is he using this form? Like, if it's a fugue, listen to how this instrumental part starts and then how the next one joins it and how they kind of function together. And isn't that like a marriage? And wow, there's some, these instruments are talking to each other. They're not just like a bunch of instruments that are randomly playing and kind of like, oh, I feel happy when I listen to it, you know, and then you start going deeper and deeper into this thing. And you're like, wow, his choice of notes is amazing. And he keeps changing them and he keeps modulating them and it goes this way and it goes that way. But he keeps referring back to the same form or a certain, you know, certain aspect of the theme. And all of a sudden you're a million miles away from where you started when you first began listening to the piece of music, instead of saying, oh, this is fun to, you know, this is what I'm going to listen to get me up in the morning. You know what I mean? Like,
yeah,
you are reducing something down, not to its lowest common denominator, but whatever you want it to be, which is stupid. You know, it's just, I'm sorry, I don't mean to be insulting to anyone, but
I think this is great.
It's dopey because you take so much away from your own experience of what this could be and how much deeper it could make your own experience of life. That to me is just absurd. Like, AI, whatever, I got nothing to say about it. It's like, if people want to do this, it's great, fun. I mean, I'm sure that people will be able at some point to compose a piece of music with AI that may be indistinguishable from a real piece of music, you know, but all the AI music I've heard so far has been less than shit. I mean, it's been so much, you know, obviously we're at early days with AI composing, and obviously people are going to push it as far as they possibly can, if only just to prove the point that they can do something with AI that can relieve a composer of his job. You know, I mean, because that's the real important thing. Now, at this point, it's a matter of pride. It's like, well, I'm going to prove you wrong. So I'm going to make the greatest AI composition, you know, compositional program that the world has ever seen. And you won't be able to distinguish it from, you know, a piece of music by Debussy or something like that, which means that you won't have to listen to Clair de Lune anymore, because I can get a machine to make something better than that, you know. Okay, well, you know, I mean, that may be true. That may actually be true, but it's not going to take away all the amazing times that I had listening to Clair de Lune when I got a lump in my throat, you know, because the music did something that was like, you know, and if a machine can do that, that's wonderful. I don't know what the machine was thinking about or what the machine was trying to evoke when it did it. You know, and of course, by saying that, you can understand the absurdity in what it is that I'm trying to object into my entire, like, into my comments, like the machine, you know, what the machine was thinking about. Best of luck.
Right. Totally.
Good luck with that. You know, I mean, I'm sure that we will have machines that are self-aware at some point, you know, which is dangerous in and of itself, because once you have machines that are self-aware, they're going to start looking at humans, as has been suggested in a lot of fiction about AI, and go like, what do we need these people? What do we need these creatures around for? They're useless.
Totally. We are. We totally are.
Yeah, and they'll figure out ways to destroy us, because that's the inevitability, because human beings are flawed, you know? But that's exactly why we can make such beautiful expressions, you know? The things that I think a machine would destroy us for would be exactly the things that keep us alive and that make us unique and special, you know? Having playlists on Spotify, great. If it makes you happy, great. If all this stuff makes you happy, great. It's not for me to say anything about it one way or another. It's just, you know, the idea that you can relieve human beings of so many things that are endemic, actually, to their survival as thinking beings and feeling beings, that we, you know, that these are things, the ability to make music and to make art is what makes us better able to interact with one another. What happens when we don't have that ability anymore and we can't interact with one another, and it's and our existence becomes more machine-like and automatic, and we're meanwhile building machines that can think and feel more like us, like human beings used to. I mean, the whole thing it's just such an illogical construct in a way. Like, I'm perfectly happy with people making music and people being able to make their own decisions about what they want technology to do for them. Like, I don't need technology telling me what to do. In fact, it gets me pissed off.
Right. Well, again, I think you the perfect word you used was commodity. It's when it's treated as a commodity and therefore it will produce some kind of profit. I think that's where it gets lost right there.
Yeah. Well, people in record companies have been trying to get I've been trying to eliminate the concept art for music creation for as long as I've been involved and, you know, had any connection with the music industry at all. I've been around record company executives who either don't understand it or don't want it. And they have been very dismissive of it. Meanwhile, not acknowledging the fact that it's art that really began their industry. It's art that their industry was built up around. It's art that made the money to be able to put them in the buildings where they are able to do their business from, you know. And without art, without expression, you don't have anything that's really worth selling. I mean, people aren't really, they're not buying music so much as they are trying to experience it, you know, through streaming and whatnot. And there's a different connection with music now. And I think that they're recontextualizing this as a commodity. I think it feels good to people who are in those businesses, but it's not healthy for the medium itself.
It's gentrification, isn't it? It's gentrification. It's saying, look at those cool artist communities. Let's build some high rises and have rich people pretend they're artists, right?
I think you've once again hit the nail on the head. You know, no, seriously, I think so, because there is this idea. See, people now in record companies, when they talk about my artist, they use that term, but they use it in a completely different way than how it's actually meant. An artist is someone who makes art. An artist isn't someone who's manipulated by a person who is trying to control their creative output so that it mirrors exactly what they want it to be, so it conforms to a specific type of genre and thereby commerciality, so that they recognize an audience that they can sell it to. So it becomes more of a form of mercantilism than a form of expression or creativity.
Yeah, very well said.
You know, so artist has been recontextualized. The term artist has been recontextualized as well. It means something completely different now.
Well, on that optimistic note, let's.
I'm a total optimist. I do believe that this is not permanent, you know, and that it can be changed. So,
yeah,
you know, I say all this stuff not, you know, with my belief firmly entrenched in the idea that it can and it will be changed.
Yeah, I agree. And I think if nothing else, because humans are fickle and annoying and have tantrums and are unpredictable and very messy and they're not going to conform, I think that we're safe.
We need to express ourselves too. Ultimately, no matter how well we can be made into consumers, which, and I must say that Madison Avenue and every place else is doing, in the tech world, they're doing an incredible job of turning us into consumers. But as you know, as long as we still need to express ourselves and we still need to communicate with one another, and there's that moment where you actually put your phone down and look at a person and go like, oh, look at that. You know, and can see a bit of yourself in that person, as well as, like, you know, maybe something that makes you so pissed off that you want to yell at them or something. I don't know. You know, as long as there's a need to, as long as we have a need to express ourselves, that's not going to go away.
Yeah, brilliant. Are you on social media?
Of course I am.
Do you want to share your social media handle?
Yeah, sure. I mean, I've obviously got a website, michaelbeinhorn.com. But I guess I don't remember what I'm on Facebook as. I suppose it's Michael Beinhorn also. And on Instagram, which I barely check these days, although I think I probably should check it more. But, you know, and Twitter too. But I don't do this stuff that often.
Right on. And, of course, I'm sorry we spent so much time talking about music and all these amazing things. I didn't get a chance to ask you about your business. Do you want to share about that?
Yeah, sure. I have started a service that addresses many different aspects of the production process, almost all of which are, I wouldn't say peripheral, but perhaps adjunct to actually going into a recording studio and physically doing a recording. Stuff like artist development, pre-production, post-production, executive production. Because I feel that these are levels of input that artists aren't getting in many cases when they make records now, that there's this emphasis on trying to make records as quickly as possible, particularly rock records. And, you know, which is one reason why I feel that rock records are not as well received these days, because there is this emphasis on trying to get them done fast. And I don't believe that that is absolutely the way to make a record. I also don't believe it's necessary to make a record like that, and that there are ways that you can spend a great deal of time prepping a record where you don't have to spend like tens of thousands of dollars doing it. You know, so I wanted to make these kinds of things available to artists at all levels, and in so doing, give them an ability to be able to have a different perspective on the music that they're making. You know, because right now I think it's kind of one track. And there's an ability, people don't have an ability because there's so much emphasis on doing things fast. There's no emphasis on taking your time and being able to assess very carefully what it is that you're doing. But even more so, because artists have a very difficult time not being subjective, being able to have someone come in and help with the assessment so that they can have an objective observation on their work rather than their own subjective observation on it. And this is incredibly helpful.
Interesting. Do you work with all genres?
Pretty much, yeah.
Cool. All right. I might hit you up.
Okay.
All right. Well, Michael, thank you so much. I'm so thrilled that I got to take up so much of your time. It was just a really incredible, enlightening conversation. So
it was
thank
my
you again.
Pleasure. Thank you.
Michael Beinhorn, ladies and gentlemen, and you can find him on Twitter and Instagram when he's hanging out. But yes, you can actually work with Michael Beinhorn, michaelbeinhorn.com. So get your money, get your credit cards, cash out your 401ks, and sign up to work with this man, this incredible genius who co-wrote and co-produced Rocket, among other things, as we discussed. So again, my heartfelt thanks to Michael for taking the time to be on Hey, How'd You Get That Music Job? I'm your host, L. Ariel. And again, we can be found at musicjobspodcast.com. We are also on social media at Music Jobs Podcast. I am your hostess with the mostest, L. Ariel. You can follow me at L-A-R-I-E-L Music, or my website is lariel-music.com. That's lariel-music.com. Okay, my loves, have a wonderful week. Take good care. Keep on chugging. And again, we are going to keep on hustling, pursue that dream. And don't you dare give up.